Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush Friday Interview Edition. Very excited about this one, you guys, because I have Steve Hyden in his house, not in my house. Where are you from? Where are you calling in from?
I am just right outside of Minneapolis.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, nice rock and roll town.
Yeah, where are you?
I'm in Atlanta, another great rock and roll town.
There you go.
And for those of you, for the uninitiated, the reason I keep talking about rock and roll already is because Steve is the co-host of one of my favorite podcasts here on our own network called Rivals. And it's about, and I've talked about it a lot on the show, so people kind of know it, but it's about famous kind of music beefs in the industry spawned from a book that you wrote called Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and thank you for having me on your show, by the way. And
of course, man.
And I'm thrilled that you like Rivals. It's a lot of fun to do. You know, it's funny because when this show first came up, it wasn't actually my idea to do the show. iHeartRadio approached me. I think they already had the idea that they wanted to do a show about music rivalries. And then they knew I wrote this book, so they thought I'd be a good host for it.
Oh, interesting.
And I thought, like, are we going to have enough rivalries, like, to do a show? And
right.
It's amazing, like, as we get into this, that there's, like, still tons of good beefs that we haven't even gotten to yet. And we've almost done like 50 episodes. So, I mean, there's like a lot of conflict in music history, yeah. Fortunately.
it's pretty great. And it's funny because I kind of wondered the same thing. I was like, you know, what kind of legs does this have? And then, you know, I'm listening basically on a weekly basis. I am a little bit behind right now. I'm typing it in now so I can look and see what the most recent episodes are. But, I keep thinking of new rivalries myself, and I'm like, no, there's plenty left to explore from these guys.
Right. And, you know, the thing, too, that really opens it up is, you know, just realizing that pretty much, like, every great band had some sort of, like, rivalry within the band. Like,
yeah,
you know, there'd be, like, two songwriters who feuded, or they're, you know, the singer and the guitar player had a feud, you know. So, like, those, like intra-band rivalries, I think, are my favorite, like where it's like two people in the same band who can't stand yeah. each other, but they have to make yeah. it work, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking now. The most recent one I just listened to was, and I kind of jumped around at this point, was Sting versus the Police.
Right.
Just because I'm such a Police fan, and it's such an interesting thing where these three guys that weren't best friends and two guys that seem like they really just didn't like each other.
Yeah, and like it, just the combination of people doesn't really make any sense on paper. You know, you have this drummer who was in a prog rock band. You have the bass player who was already playing jazz music, you know, before
right.
the Police was really Sting's only rock band that he ever played in. And yeah. then Andy Summers, who was like almost 40 years old, like when the Police
so crazy.
Kicked off. And yet they come together and it's like, you know, like, what's a catchier band than the Police? Like, what's an easier band to like than the Police? It just yeah. came together and created this very accessible, popular sound. And, you know, that's the magic of music. Like, why do things like that work? You know, who knows?
Yeah, totally. I have a little bit of bitter taste in my mouth over the Police because I went and saw that reunion tour.
Oh, man.
And just, you know, I mean, the music was fine, but it just felt so phoned in, at least at the show where I was at. They came in from clearly separate entrances. You got the idea that they had separate rooms, got on separate limos, and literally only saw each other on stage. And that you could just feel the lack of love on stage, and that sucked.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you say you're from Atlanta. I co-wrote a book with my friend Steve Gorman about one of the great Atlanta bands, in my opinion, the Black Crowes.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that too.
And, you know, I still love the Black Crowes, even though I like worked on this book and it's just about how awful things were in the band. And there's like lots of things that Steve told me that aren't in the book. Like there's things that he couldn't put in there because they were so bad. And yet, and yet I still like the band. So I feel like I have a pretty high tolerance for musicians not liking each other and then not ruining the band for me, because I definitely think that there's like some people who like shouldn't read biographies, because I think for some people there's this idea that like a band is a family or like a gang. And when you find out that in reality, you know, and especially for the bands that are around for a long time, they always end up disliking each other. And I think that's kind of natural. It's like, you know, think
of kind of like a family.
It is like a family. Or, you know, think of like how common is it to make a friend when you're like 16, 17, 18 years old and still be friends with them when you're 50? You know, like that's a pretty unique thing. I mean, I have some childhood friends still, but like I don't see them every day. I'm not in a band with them. If I did see them every day, maybe we wouldn't be friends anymore. I mean, I think the thing with the show, it's great for music fans, but I also think it's just an interesting show about human relationships, you know, and like
totally.
And you just see how certain patterns recur no matter what kind of band it is. You know, it could be a metal band, it could be a country band or a funk band, whatever. People still have the same hangups and, you know, wanting power or feeling like you're underappreciated, you know,
underpaid,
you know, insecurity, you know, feeling like you're not getting the respect from this person that is supposed to love you, and how it just eats at you for years and then it just blows up, you know, like a decade or two later.
Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, because bands, you know, when bands get together, and especially when you're a music lover like we are and like so many people are, it's usually, and you know, the case of like, you know, there are always the outliers like the Pixies who all just answered an ad. And I assume there will be a Kim Deal versus Black Francis or the Pixies episode at some point. But
totally,
that's an outlier. You know, usually people get together because they are friends, because they have similar sensibilities and they love each other. And to see those relationships fracture is really kind of depressing. I think the people, the U2s and the REMs, did it right, and that they were like, listen, we're a band and we're all going to divide this thing up equally. And there's never going to be a question about payment and who makes more and who writes more stuff. And from that point, all you have to do is have a chief songwriter who can live with that, because that's a lot of times where it goes wrong is a few years in, someone's like, man, I'm doing all the work. And these guys, like the drummer's not even writing shit.
Right.
And so why am I splitting my thing up, you know, 25% a piece?
Yeah, that's definitely a huge thing. I also think that the bands that stick around with all the original members are the bands like where each person knows what their role is and they're okay with that. Like you mentioned U2, and like Larry Mullen Jr. isn't causing a stink because he wants to be the singer. You know, he's not like pushing to
Stuart
like have
Copeland.
He's not pushing like to have his songs put to the forefront. Like he understands that Bono is the singer, the Edge is like the main music guy, and he's the drummer. Or, you know, I just wrote a book about Radiohead, and like Radiohead's another band that like all the same members, the same you know, throughout their entire history. And that's another thing where it's like, yeah, Tom York, he's the songwriter, Johnny Greenwood is the guy who like helps realize his idea sonically. The guys in the rhythm section are the rhythm section. Ed O'Brien is like the texturalist guy. And they all know their roles and they're comfortable with it. And in the bands where that's not true, that's where you have problems. Like where the bass player wants to sing.
Yeah.
And he wants to be the guy on the album cover, not the singer. All those sort of petty jealousies that come to the fore.
Yeah, for sure. And Radiohead's one of my favorite bands. And I do have that book. And it's sitting on my nightstand right now. And it is your fault I haven't read it. It's called This Isn't Happening, and it's mainly about the making of Kid A, one of the just landmark albums, although it seems like Radiohead puts out nothing but landmark albums.
Right.
Moonshaped Hula is one of my favorites, and that's their most recent. But I got into the Bob Spitz Beatles book on your recommendation the show, and that, you know, the breadth of that book, it has been a bit of a slog, a fun slog, but it's long as hell. And so that's why Radiohead is still sitting on my nightstand, but that's next up for me.
Well, it's crazy because I just picked up, I don't know if you're familiar with this, like, I think his name is Mark Lewison. He's like a big Beatles historian, and he's working on like just a mammoth Beatles book that's going to be 3 volumes.
Oh, wow.
And he put out the first volume, I think it was like 6 years ago, and that's like 900 pages. And it's just about Beatles up until like 1963.
Yeah.
You know, so it's almost like Mark Caro, he does those Lyndon Johnson biographies. Yeah. You know, he's got, it's the same thing there. So I just bought that. I haven't started reading that yet, but yeah, if you think the Spitz book is long, you know, this book is longer than that. And it's just, you know, their, you know, childhood and Hamburg years and stuff. It's not even their sort of prime yet, but I'm excited to get into that. I mean, the Beatles story, you know, I've seen so many documentaries about them. I've read so many books. I never get sick of that story.
Same here.
And it has all the elements that we were just talking about, where you have these friends from childhood.
Yeah.
They come up, they become famous, and then, you know, all these different power dynamics come into play where people are fighting for power in the band and fighting for recognition. You have John versus Paul, you know, their sort of competition going on. And then you have George Harrison, this great songwriter who
I know
is treated like the little brother in the band, not taken seriously.
Waiting in the wings. It's crazy.
They never, and we did an episode on that. They never, Lennon McCartney never reached out to George Harrison to say, hey, why don't we write songs together? It was like, no, you're like the little brother. You know, you're not going to be as good as good as us ever. And you can just see, like, when Harrison finally got out of the band, he puts out All Things Must Pass, this, like, enormous record, triple album, and he just felt like, no one's going to tell me no. I'm going to put everything on this record.
It was a bit of a middle finger to the other guys. It was like, all right, I'm going to outdo both of you.
Right.
You know, I mean, I've listened to almost every episode up until, like, a month ago when I got distracted, but the Tweety J. Farrar episode is one of my favorites. The band is one of my favorite all-time groups. So the Robbie Robertson, Levon Helm story was just, that's a tough one personally because of the finances of Levon later on in his life and really kind of all the guys, you know, were, you know, the band is one of the sadder stories in music, I think, of them, you know, without Robbie playing these kind of like, you know, washed up dive bars almost, which is just crazy to think about. I'm glad Levon had a nice career resurgence at the end with those couple of great albums. But I recently watched the documentary, what was it called? Brothers?
Once We're Brothers?
Yeah, Once We're Brothers, which, you know, it's the Robbie Robertson show, so I kind of knew what to expect. I loved all the archival footage. But, you know, I think I had the understanding that they had a real deathbed reconciliation. And not he went in there to an unconscious Levon Helm and kind of held his hand.
Right.
So that really kind of burst my bubble a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing with that conflict between Levon and Robbie, I think for the longest time, like I've sided with Levon. I mean, I love Levon so much. I love him in the band.
You have to.
Great drummer, incredible singer.
Yeah.
And, you know, Robbie Robertson's just like a less sympathetic character in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Although I think lately I've come to have more equal empathy just because I feel like, you know, from Robertson's perspective, you know, he was in a band with these like 3 genius singers and musicians, you know, Helm, Danko, and Richard Manuel. But they were all also like drug addicts and irresponsible. I'm sure like, especially after they became popular, you know, it was hard to wrangle those guys, get them into the studio. Robertson was the responsible one. You know, I think he was like writing the songs. He was putting things together. I can see from his perspective how that would have just been maddening to deal with. And maybe at some point you're just like, I got to get out of here. I'll go to Hollywood and make movies with Martin Scorsese and that'll be great.
It's alluring for sure.
But yeah, that movie, Once We're Brothers, it really does leave like a sour taste in your mouth because, you know, Robbie Robertson, you have a right to get your viewpoint out there, but you had a long time to do that and you didn't do it until the other guys were dead.
Right.
And they can't respond.
I know.
And it just seemed a little cheap. And it actually, I think, made them look worse to do that. I think a lot of people, a lot of band fans did not really respond positively to that movie. It seemed like a pretty kind of transparent, you know, sort of, you know, it's a way to like prop Robbie up basically and make the other guys not look as good. And I think if he would have been a little more honest and empathetic to Levon, he would have came out looking better and also made his case. But, you know, I don't know. That's such a complicated thing.
I know. And he always strikes me as a guy that kind of likes to hear himself talk.
Yeah.
As evidence from, you know, The Last Waltz and this documentary and his sort of, you know, shoe polish black hair at his age and the Hollywood thing. I don't know, man. It's but he's one of my favorite guitar players of all time.
Well, and that's the thing. Like I had the chance. Look, I've taken shots at Robbie Robertson, like in print, like many times, but I interviewed him.
Oh, wow.
Like 2 or 3 years ago. And he was a great interview. And, you know, whatever you want to say about him, he played on the 1966 Dylan tour, blazing lead guitar, like some of the greatest lead guitar ever. He was there with the Basement Tapes. I mean, this guy's been a part of like some of the greatest music ever made.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's arrogant and kind of a glory hog, I think, but his resume is pretty great, you know? So it's like, what are you going to do?
What's it like when you're interviewing? I mean, you're a music journalist first and foremost, and that's where your career has led you to podcasting in a secondary way. But when you're interviewing some of these people that are your idols, or just these huge superstars, what's that like? How do you keep it chill?
Well, I mean, you know, interviewing like a famous person to me like isn't that big of a deal. You know, like it is what it is. It is part of, because like they're just people. A lot of times too, it's like they're not famous for anything extraordinary necessarily. It's just like they're just famous. But if it is someone like Robbie Robertson, or like I interviewed Robert Plant once, or like a Paul Simon, that is like I'll have like nerves in the pit of my stomach starting the day before.
I mean, these are the rare humans in history.
Yeah, exactly. Where like, they're human beings, but they're built up so much, certainly in my mind, beyond that, especially someone like Robert Plant, like where, you know, I started listening to Led Zeppelin when I was like 11 or 12 years old and reading Hammer of the Gods, you know, by Stephen Davis. And, you know, and I've said this before, but you know, like I'm not a comic book guy, but
same here.
Like rock stars of the 60s and 70s, like they're my Marvel heroes.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
Like that's my, like Robert Plant is my Batman, you know.
Right.
Robbie Robertson is like my, you know, whoever, Green Lantern or whatever. I can't even think of comic book characters.
I think Robert Plant would be more of a Thor if, you know, we're going to get into the Norse mythology.
Right. But, you know, just people that are so built up in my mind that it's just incredible to talk to them. And then you talk to them and like Robert Plant was really nice and like thoughtful, and he's just a music fan at heart. So when I was interviewing him, that was something that I felt like I could connect with him. You know, like we were talking about Sandy Denny singing on The Battle of Evermore on Led Zeppelin 4. So then we started talking about like Fairport Convention and like English folk of like the late 60s and early 70s, because I like that kind of stuff. And obviously he's a huge fan of that. So, you know, we could connect just as music fans.
Is that what you're looking for?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, like when you interview someone like that, who's been interviewed so many times, you know, you don't want to ask just the standard questions that they've been asked a million times, because, you know, well, for one thing, everyone's heard that before, so it's not interesting. But also like the person you're talking to, they're not going to give you good answers. They're just going to feel like, oh, I can go on autopilot because this is just like another dumb journalist, you know, out of millions that I've talked to in my life. But I think if you can show that, you know, you care about this stuff as much as they do, I think it's a signal to them that, oh, okay, I can loosen up because this person's on the right level, and we can actually have like a real conversation. And I think that's when doors get opened and you actually end up maybe discovering something new, you know, that hasn't been rehashed, you know, a million times.
I love the story when you, I felt so bad for you, man, when you were recounting your Liam Gallagher interview and, and you know, you don't want to be the millionth guy to ask him about an Oasis reunion, but it's almost like you kind of have to, or you're being negligent. And it sounds like you didn't press it, but it was all just BDI, mate, BDI, right. mate.
Well, yeah, this
that's all you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, this was right after Oasis broke up, and he started this new band called BDI. And it was an interesting time in his career because I think he's changed quite a bit since then. He used to be much more sort of like churlish with the media. And now, like, you see interviews with him and he's like super charming and funny and much more loquacious. And I don't know if that was just something, you know, he just got older and got in a better mood.
Probably part of it.
Or maybe there might have been like substance abuse issues too. I wonder if maybe he was just more intoxicated when I talked to him. Because like you see him now and like, you know, his eyes look clearer and he looks more alert. So I do think that's maybe part of it. But yeah, when I talked to him, you know, and I said this, I think I said on the show, I asked 24 questions in 15 minutes. Because it was all just like one sentence answers.
Oh, that
but
sucks.
I'm such an Oasis fan that I was digging that. Like, it was kind of uncomfortable, but like
it was kind of a classic Gallagher move.
Yeah, I was kind of loving it just because it's like I love Liam Gallagher. I love his attitude, and I mean, so to be on the other end of it, it was kind of a dream come true to be abused by Liam Gallagher a little bit.
I'm also a big fan of the Van Halen episodes, and I'm now kind of email friends with Aaron Hagar, Sammy's son, because he's a fan of Movie Crush and Stuff You Should Know, and got in touch with us a while back, and now I can just like email him about anything. Anytime I have some little question or whatever, I can email him and he'll be like, yeah, man, whatever. I'll tell you anything. And like, I'll go ask my dad right now.
Oh,
and
cool.
Like, Sammy says hi. He thinks it's so cool. And it's just like, Sammy, you know, I'm obviously a big David Lee Roth Van Halen guy because that was the original lineup when I was a kid. But I loved both. I loved Van Hagar. And I think Sammy Hagar is one of the more kind of cool, endearing guys in rock history. He just seems like a good guy. And Aaron's like, man, he's great. He's a great dad and always was.
Yeah. I interviewed Sammy, like maybe 10 years ago when he put out his memoir Red, which I think I said this in the episode. I think that's like one of the underrated rock memoirs. I don't hear that like mentioned when people talk about great rock books, but it's like a pretty entertaining
book. I haven't read that one yet.
Yeah. He's like, I mean, his personality comes across in the book pretty clearly. And I mean, there's like a lot of trash talking about Eddie Van Halen. So like there's that aspect of the book, just talking about basically how messed up Eddie Van Halen was during that period. But like even the stuff like before he joins the band, it is pretty fun. And I mean, he has the whole aliens thing, like how he talks about how he had an alien encounter when he was, I think, 20 years old or so. So that's pretty wild. But yeah, when I interviewed him, you know, we talked for a long time. It was like over an hour. And it was one of those things like where I think we went over our time that we were allotted by the publicist. But he was just like, you know, just whatever you have, just keep asking me questions. You know, I'll go as long as you want. And I think that's just his attitude. He seems like a pretty, you know, like man of the people type guy. You know, so I appreciate that about him.
Did you grow up in Minneapolis?
No, I'm from Wisconsin originally. Okay. I grew up in a town called Appleton, which is not far from Green Bay. It's about a half hour south of Green Bay. So
gotcha.
Still a big Packers fan, even though I'm in Minnesota now. But I've lived here for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
And I love it. I love it here, even though we're now entering our winter hell here. although it still isn't too bad here, I have to say. But yeah, January and February are always tough months for me. But after that, it's great. I like seasons too. I'm pro seasons.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a good friend there, and Stuff You Should Know always does really well there on tours. It's a great, I think it's a great town for artistic, very literate sort of cultured people. And very, you know, it's a great rock and roll town. Everyone from The Replacements to Husker Du and Soul Asylum and obviously Prince. It's just got a great rock and roll tradition. This indie band Tapes and Tapes is one of my favorite indie bands of all time, and I've gotten to know those guys actually by touring and inviting them to the show and stuff. And just a cool town. Hold Steady, obviously.
Yeah. Although they came together in Brooklyn, Craig Finn lived here for a long time, and all of his songs are set here. So
right.
They're really like the Bruce Springsteen of Minneapolis, like how you listen to Springsteen songs
yeah,
and he's name checking specific towns and bridges and all that stuff. And Hold Steady songs, he talks about like 169 and like that's literally like half a mile from my house, you know? So, so that's a cool thing about listening to Hold Steady songs. If you happen to be, you know, from this
all
area.
The rest.
Yeah.
When did you start writing about music and think that that was a career path for you?
Well, I started when I was 14, really. I mean, I wrote for my junior high paper. The first record reviews I ever wrote were of Automatic for the People by R.E.M.
Oh, cool. And, one of my favorites.
And Dirt by Alice in Chains. Those were the first
another
two
favorite.
Records. I gave Automatic for the People an A, and I gave Dirt a B+, and I should have given that an A too. That's an A record,
you know.
I think. My 14-year-old self, I have to write him an angry letter about that.
Right.
I started writing for my like daily local newspaper. They had a teen page that I started writing for when I was 15, and I was getting paid for that. I was getting like $10, I think, a column.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just had it programmed in me, I think, to be a music critic. You know, I just started doing it like pretty early, and I've been really writing ever since. You know, I did it throughout high school. I wrote for my college paper.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got hired by the same paper that I wrote for as a teenager. That was my first job out of college. So I worked for a daily newspaper, worked for alt weeklies, you know, kind of did a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
And that's what's been cool about doing podcasts, because, you know, I love doing podcasts. It's a lot of fun, and it's just like the next iteration of different media that I've worked in, you know, because like daily newspapers, they still exist, but they're obviously on the decline. Alt weeklies are almost gone at this point. You know, I'm working in digital media, but that's always pretty volatile. So, you know, you just have to be able to roll with the punches. I guess I'll be doing TikTok reviews here pretty soon. You know, it seems like I just saw a story in Rolling Stone about how the future of music journalism is TikTok.
Oh,
so,
good Lord.
So we'll see about that. But yeah, I've always liked it. You know, and it just came from a very simple impulse of I love writing and I love music. So like, how can I combine this? And I was able to pull it off. So
amazing.
I feel really fortunate. That.
What book do you want to write next? Can you talk about that, or what ideas are brewing?
Well, I have an agreement to write a book. I haven't officially signed the contract yet. So I'm starting work on something right now that I won't say yet. But if you like my other books, I think you'll like this one. It's in a similar vein. You know, I'm not going off and doing a book about Right Said Fred or something, you know, although that would be cool. I would definitely do a Right Said Fred book if I could sell that, but
I don't know about that.
Yeah. But, so I'm just about to start really writing that. And so that'll be out in 2022. That's what I'm working on right now. And there's always like different projects I have kind of percolating that I want to do. It's just about whether you can actually pull them off.
Right.
Or get someone to buy it. But I've been pretty lucky with that too. So hopefully that will continue.
So a couple of questions about your youth. What was your first And this is not a, hey, I got to give this guy a cool answer. What was your first real music love? And I'll just go ahead and level set and say, legit, mine was Barry Manilow.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's got some good tunes. I mean, you know, I was born in 1977, so like it was natural for me, like around 5 or 6, to really love Thriller. Like I loved Thriller because everyone loved Thriller. Yeah. So I'll say that, although I feel like that almost doesn't count because it was like so ubiquitous at that time. So I remember like the first rock band I loved was Huey Lewis and the News.
Yeah, man.
I had sports on cassette.
It's such a good album.
I had that. And then Four, I had that on cassette as well. And
yeah, I had those records.
I actually got to spend time with Huey Lewis too. I wrote a profile of him in 2013, and which was pretty wild too, you know? Because he was a huge deal for me. Yeah, because, you know, it's wild to think of a band like that being pop stars now, because it's like a guy who looks like Huey Lewis, like just imagine him being a pop star. It's so strange. But like, you know, like when I was a little kid, you know, in the mid 80s, they had sports, you know, they had the Back to the Future song,
sure, and what was bigger than that,
and they had Four, you know, which had Hip to Be Square on it, and like a bunch of other hits. So like from like 83 to 86 87, I mean, they were like as big as any band, really. Huey Lewis and the News, they taught me about the heart of rock and roll. And I'm grateful for
those
that.
Those are such great songs.
Yeah. I have to say too that, like, you know, I made a joke about that, but like I think I did learn from the heart of rock and roll that like Cleveland is an important city in the history of rock music, you know, because of Alan Freed and all that stuff. And like, you know, this is the heart of rock and roll is in Cleveland is the lyric from that song. So Huey Lewis, bit of a music historian there, and taught me something with that song.
My wife's family is from Akron. They all live here now in Atlanta, but and followed her here, but I went to Cleveland and Akron a bunch over the years, and went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is, you know, I want to go back. It's just an amazing place to visit. And my wife went to Firestone High, home of Chrissy Hynde and the Black Keys and Devo, and I think there was one more. All went to Firestone High.
Wow.
Which is a pretty incredible, you know, from a single high school, pretty incredible lineage.
Yeah, well, in Ohio in general, tons of great bands.
Yeah.
Maybe my favorite band of all time, Guided by Voices from Dayton, Ohio. Like, huge Guided by Voices fan. And then you have the National. I mean, they started, like, those guys are from Cincinnati.
Yeah,
it's another
sure.
band that kind of like, I think they came together in Brooklyn, but
James Gang.
Absolutely. Yeah. Ohio. Great. And, you know, I love the wave, the flag for Midwestern rock bands.
Yeah.
You know, like I wave the flag for the Midwest in general, but yeah, I always love to see Midwest stepping up, doing something. I mean, I'm from Wisconsin. There's not like a ton of great bands really. From Wisconsin, unfortunately. We have like the Violent Femmes and the Bodines. Of course,
I remember the Bodines.
Bon Iver is the big one now, which is cool.
Oh, sure.
And I went to school in Eau Claire, which is where Justin is from. So he actually wrote a song. There's a song on the second Bon Iver record called Towers, which is about one of the dorms on UW Eau Claire campus. There's Towers North and Towers South.
Yeah.
And I lived in Towers North my freshman year. So
there's a song about your college dorm.
I know. See, and it's like, look, when you live in the Midwest, you have to like grasp onto these things. It's not like when you live in New York and there's like a million New York songs, you know, like every Lou Reed song you can just point to and be like, oh yeah, it's about my town.
Well, R.E.M. never wrote a song about Reed Hall, so I'm a little disappointed.
Oh yeah. Athens. I love Athens. Is a great town.
You know, I was just there last weekend for the first time in a while, and my daughter was at my mom's house spending the night, and my wife had an event all day, and I was like, you know what? I haven't been to Athens in forever. I have a day to myself, and I went and just soaked it all in again. It was like the best 6 years of my life, of my youth, let's say. And the REM steeple is still there from the church where they played their first gig.
I've seen that.
It's still right there. I mean,
I've seen
they preserved it.
Yeah.
It's cool.
And you and can they, also, and they also have like those tower things that are on the back cover of Murmur.
Yeah, the train trestle.
The train trestle. Yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah, you can go and see that.
River D's is still there. Automatic for the People was this local soul food restaurant, and all that stuff is within like, you know, a half a mile of a couple of places that I lived. And Stipe still owns, I think he owns three houses now, which is, I think the rich guy move, which is you buy your house and then eventually you buy the neighboring house and then eventually you buy the other side neighboring house.
Right.
Just to sort of sock yourself in a little bit. But I know he lives in New York, but, you know, he's still there and you could go on any given night and bump into Stipe still, even though he spends most of his time in New York. And I think that's one of the charming things about that band is that they still have, you know, Bill Berry still lives just outside Athens on his farm.
Yeah, Berry's the one member of REM I haven't interviewed.
Oh, no.
I'd love to interview Bill Berry. I remember when I interviewed Michael Stipe, that was another one where I had the knot in my stomach the night before.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, still am such a huge REM fan. And I'd also heard that he was like a bit standoffish in interviews, could be difficult. And he couldn't have been warmer and nicer and like
That's great.
And more open. Like we were talking about all these different I mean, it was just about REM, our interview, and he you know, was very frank about like what he thought the band did well and what, you know, he thought they didn't do well.
Interesting.
Very matter of fact, and, you know, had a great sense of humor. And yeah, all those guys, they are one of the only bands that, like, when they walked away, you felt like, okay, they're done, because they just seem like guys that who feel like, okay, we did what we wanted to do, and now we want to be normal. We want to have normal lives. And they don't seem to have, you know, the ego that, like, other bands of that level would have, like, where eventually you want to be in front of 50,000 people again. You know, like, I've seen Peter Buck play with so many different bands.
Yeah, that, he just loves it.
Like, he'll play with Alejandro Escovedo. He'll, like, he'll put out a record on, like, with that, I think that label Mississippi Records, like out in Oregon, where it's like you can only buy it on vinyl and it's like, you know, 2,000 copies pressed or whatever. Like,
that's so cool.
And he's, you know, and he's just a guy who just, he's like, you know, got tens of millions of dollars, I'm sure. And he's just like, I don't need to be a superstar anymore. I can just do whatever I want to do. And I just want to play music. And I can't think of like another band that was like that huge.
Yeah,
where the members just did that, walked away, and I really think, like, I don't think they'll ever get back together.
I think you're right.
In a real way. I think they could do, I could see them getting back together and playing a show at the 40 Watt, and that's the only time they get to back together. But in terms of doing, like, a real tour or, like, an album or something, I'm sure that won't happen.
Yeah, the 40 Watt, man. Many, many nights there. That, one of my, I guess my favorite, sort of college rock band of all time is Pavement. And I saw Pavement and on that first tour for Slanted, without even knowing who they were. It was just, there's a great, alt weekly there called the Flagpole Magazine. And I thought you were about to whip out the flagpole. You just reach for something. The flagpole, you know, it was in Athens in the early 90s, and you would just read up like who's playing the 40 Watt for $4 on a Wednesday. And like, let's just take a flyer and go. And Pavement had an interesting write up. And I was like, let's go check these guys out. And from that night on, I was like, these are my guys. And they have remained my guys ever since then. It was sort of a shit show of a concert. Gary, the drummer at the time, just destroyed his drum set. And Steve Malkmus ended up passed out on the stage with like cigarettes falling out of his breast pocket. And he came back and apologized. And I was like, man, these guys are the shit. They're my dudes.
That's awesome. I got to see Drive-By Truckers there. That's the only
cool.
Because I was in town to do a story on them. And they do this thing. I mean, they didn't do it this year, obviously, but like they do this thing in the winter where they play like a 3-show stand at the 40 Watt. So I was at one of those shows, and that was definitely like pretty cool to be at the 40 Watt. Just,
man, they're so good.
Having like grown up a huge REM fan and knowing about the 40 Watt.
It's a great club.
Just from reading about them. Yeah. And I love Athens too. It reminds me of Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm
sure. Which is, you know, like another sort of like liberal college town.
yep.
in the middle of like just conservative country. It's like a little yeah. oasis, you know?
Yeah, like Austin too.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Austin's a bigger city, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so it felt very comfortable when I was there. It felt, you know, like, oh, I haven't been here before, but I feel like I have.
Yeah, that's cool. Stuff You Should Know did a sort of an off the beaten path live show in Lawrence, Kansas one time. And I got those Athens vibes big time when I was in Lawrence. I was like, man, this town is the shit. I love what it's about.
Yeah, totally. I haven't been there, but I've heard good
things.
It's
awesome. And then another sort of childhood music question before we move on to what we're going to be talking about, which is music movies. What was your first concert? Like, what, you know, you consider your first real concert? I like, my parents dragged me to Kenny Rogers and Bobby Goldsboro when I was a kid, but like my first show that I wanted to go to and paid for was Cheap Trick in 1983.
Oh, wow. That's another great Midwestern band.
Yeah. And one of them, I've seen them probably 9 or 10 times, including a weird 40 watt. And I'm not weird. It was great. It was kind of weird that they played there. This epic 40 watt show, like 15 years ago. But, what was your first real concert?
Well, like in terms of like a show that I was taken to, like by my dad, it was when I was 9, I saw the Beach Boys at the Marcus Amphitheater in Milwaukee. It was the first show at the Marcus Amphitheater, which is where Summerfest takes place in Milwaukee, for those uh-huh. who know what Summerfest is. And that would have been like 1986. Okay. And
the Kokomo years?
It was right before Kokomo. So, okay. So it, you know, it was just like a greatest hit set. And I was so young, you know, I didn't really even know who the Beach Boys were. Although, like, when they started playing, I knew a lot of their songs already from oldies radio.
Right.
And I had a great time. I loved it. I'm trying to, I wish I knew if Brian Wilson was there, because it's possible that he might have been at that show, but I don't know if he was or not. But certainly Carl Wilson was still with them. Dennis Wilson sure. had died, you know, 3 years before that. So that was pretty cool. Like, and I loved the Beach Boys. So that was pretty great.
Another great Rivals episode, by the way, yeah, the Mike Love one.
Yeah, totally.
Legendary asshole.
Like, in terms of, like, you know, a show that I paid for myself, like, one of the first big ones was I saw the Rolling Stones on the Voodoo Lounge Tour in 1994 yep. at Camp Randall Stadium in Madison. And I was, I think, literally in the last row. And, you know, I was already a big classic rock fan when I was 16. And I remember feeling like a little snarky about, like, oh, you know, is this going to be any good? Mm-hmm. You know, because at that time, the Stones seemed super old, you know, and I thought, oh, they're going to retire. Well, Mick Jagger was 50 on that tour.
I know.
And, you know, at that time, there weren't a lot of 50-year-old rock stars in 94. You know, now, you know, we're used to, I mean, Bob Dylan's going to be 80 next year. So that's been normalized. But I remember thinking, like, I got to see the Stones on this tour because they're going to probably retire after this, you know? And that was like 26 years ago. But
that's so funny.
They came out, and I forget what they played first, but it was awesome. It was unbelievable. And I even in a stadium, like, the magnetism of Mick and Keith especially was just, it was intoxicating. Like, I was in heaven during that show. I remember they played All Down the Line from Exile on Main Street, and I loved Exile, and I wasn't expecting them to play that. So I was pretty excited, and Keith sang 3 songs, I think, including Memory Hotel from Black and Blue, which is, you know, not a hit.
Yeah.
Pretty big deep cut. Any Keith sung songs, I was going nuts for, because I loved Keith Richards. Was one of the first like rock stars I really came to love, and I still love Keith. But at that time, especially, I just worshipped Keith Richards. So that's pretty great. So yeah, probably the Stones would be like one of the first like kind of like shows I paid to go see, and that was a big deal too, because I had to get permission to like drive down. That was like a 2-hour drive. And so, yeah, that was great. That was so much fun.
They are remarkably a band I haven't seen. I mean, I've been going to concerts, like I said, since I was 12 years old, and like big shows. You know, when I was little, I was going to the Omni in Atlanta, you know, our local, you know, basketball arena. And obviously once college kicked in, I was going to like smaller shows along with big shows still. But I have some big holes. Like, I've never seen the Stones. I never got to see The Who. And I had a chance to see The Who in the 80s when it was still, you know, pretty vital. And John Entwistle was still with them. I never got to see Pink Floyd. I never saw that. I didn't go to that Plant Page tour. I never saw Bowie. Like, some of my idols, I'm just kicking myself for not going to these shows, you know. And I guess part of it was finances back then, like not being able to afford to go to all the shows. I've got a great concert list, but those are some pretty big holes to have not seen the Stones at all. With so many opportunities, I really regret that.
Well, and hopefully you'll still have a chance. I mean, I was gonna see them this year again. Yeah. Like, they were gonna, you know, they were going on tour, and there was a month in May where I was going to see the Stones, Guns N' Roses, and Ween, and I was like, this is gonna be great. and I had that planned in like February or whatever, and then you know, we all know what happened next. I mean, but like someone like Bowie, for instance, like I've never seen Bowie either. And it's just like, oh, you know, that's gone forever. You know, like we're never going to get a chance to see that, which is a real bummer. Or I never saw Pink Floyd either. I've seen Roger Waters, which was pretty great. Like, his band is so good.
Yeah.
And he has this guitar player, when I saw him, named Jonathan Wilson, who's a great singer-songwriter in his own right and great producer. Like, he's produced all the Father John Misty records and like Dawes and other bands like that. But he was the guitar player in Roger Waters' band, and he would sing the David Gilmour parts too.
Oh yeah.
And it was so perfect. And like, the guitar solos that he was playing were like note for note from the record, which I'm a little mixed on.
Right.
But also, those solos are amazing. So
you want to hear them.
I was kind of excited to sit in, you know, I was in an arena with an amazing light show, listening to like the guitar solo from Comfortably Numb.
You know, just like, pretend it's David Gilmour.
Yeah, I was like, this is pretty cool. Like, it's like, you can be cynical about these things and be like, oh, it's not the real band, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when you're in that seat, that plastic seat, and the light show's going and that music is playing, I'm sorry, but like I can be a cynical rock critic, but my cynicism evaporates. It's like, I'm not that powerful of a cynic.
Yeah.
It's like, this stuff is working for me like gangbusters, you know, like there's a reason why this is so popular. Like, it works.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I had tickets for the Roger Waters tour this summer. Really good seats. Didn't happen. I had tickets for Guns N' Roses. Didn't happen.
Well,
I have been on a mission now to just not miss these big shows, especially if it's an older artist. Like, I went and saw that Elton John tour 3 times.
Oh yeah.
And the Fleetwood Mac, both with Lindsay and then with Campbell and Neil Finn. And that was great. So I try not to miss anything now that I can actually afford to go to concerts and get like decent seats finally in my life.
Right.
I saw Petty, you know, from like the 5th row on that last tour, and I think the 2 previous tours as well. So I'm not, and certainly after the pandemic is over, like, no one should be snoozing on live tours ever again.
And that's why, you know, part of me is like, oh, are people going to be afraid to go to shows? Because there's such a, you know, I know, like, when I went to shows, I never thought about germs. You know, I never thought about like someone coughing 10 rows ahead of me and me feeling like, oh, well, I'm in danger now. But then there's the thing you're talking about where people are so primed, you know,
it'll take a minute.
I mean, like, you know, I managed to see a couple things in early 2020, a couple live shows, but this is easily the least amount of music I've seen since I was what, like 16 years old.
It's been crazy.
And that's true for everyone, obviously. But yeah, it's such a, it's really weird. I mean, there's so many things that we've lost that I try not to dwell on it too much because it can really drag you down.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, hopefully we'll
make up for it.
Yeah. Hopefully we're on the verge of coming back, and it will be so fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all right, my friend, let us segue here into music movies. And what I did, everyone, is I emailed Steve and was just like, listen, let's just not hem ourselves in. Make a list of your favorite five music movies. It can be concert movies, can be documentaries, can be biopics, it can be whatever. And you are fully allowed to cheat like crazy because I'm looking at my top five list and it has probably 13 movies and then another 12 honorable mentions.
Oh, man.
So let's just start talking about these. I'll go ahead and just start it off. And these are not, for me, they're not ranked. I think you ranked yours. But
yeah,
on my list of top five, I kind of tried to categorize it. I did concert movies, and my two favorite concert movies are The Last Waltz and Stop Making Sense. Little on the nose, but yep, that's the truth.
Yep. You can't go wrong with those. Yeah, for my list, I had sort of a subcategory where I was like, I'm not going to put these on my list because I feel like people know these movies, or I feel like Charles is probably going to mention them.
Uh-huh.
And those were two that I also wanted to make sure I shouted them out because
right.
They're great. Like, I'm not saying they're not great. I'm not being like a snob here and being like, oh yeah, The Last Waltz isn't great or Stop Making Sense isn't great. Like, they're great. But I also want to like recommend some movies that maybe people haven't seen that I think are really great. But yeah, those two, if you haven't seen them, you have to see them. They're like the gold standard, I think, for concert films.
They really are. And I think in sort of two different ways and in one similar way, The Last Waltz has all that other great footage. Stop Making Sense does not do that. But I think the things they have in common, which was pretty genius from Scorsese and Jonathan Demme, was the immediacy of the film work. And I think part of that is due to the fact that just back then they didn't have, you know, 50-foot techno cranes, and like the way they shoot concerts now is so different. Back then it was people on stage with a camera largely. You know, you had one set up wide for your wide shot, but so what's so great about both of those is just the immediacy of, and especially Stop Making Sense. I mean, you don't even see the audience really.
Right.
It's this weird thing that feels like it's in this vacuum where you're kind of on stage with this avant-garde rock band. The Last Waltz feels like a bit more of a party. But they both work for those reasons, I think.
Yeah, I think Stop Making Sense is the greatest sort of visceral concert movie. Like it's the concert movie that comes closest to actually feeling like a show. Mm-hmm. Where like I've been to screenings of Stop Making Sense and people will get up and dance like during the show. And I've never seen that for other concert films. The Last Waltz to me, and I think you make a great point about how that was shot. I mean, if you look at a film like Woodstock or Gimme Shelter, like the early, you know, like those late 60s, like kind of like the early great concert films, it's more like handheld stuff. It feels like a little grittier, which I love that about those movies. But there's a grandness to The Last Waltz. It's like Gone with the Wind of concert movies. Like, it just looks so great. And the compositions of it are so wonderful, and there's just like a sweep to it that I think was really unique to concert movies at that time. And the fact too that you just have these like towering figures of rock history all assembled at once. You have like Muddy Waters on stage, you know? Yeah. Like, how amazing is that? And then you've got like Van Morrison in the purple suit. You've got like Bob Dylan with like looking like a rabbi, you know.
Totally. Neil Young and his booger nose and his cocaine booger nose.
Exactly. Neil Young with the booger nose, which someone pointed this out to me recently. If you look at the shirt that Neil Young is wearing, which I've never noticed this, but like because you can see it a couple times, it's like a drawing of two people doing a 69.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I never noticed that.
And it's like, what in the hell, Neil Young? Yeah. What are you thinking? But
that's funny. And then the great interviews, like just, you know, Robbie, of course, is bloviating about everything. But, you know, the best interviews you're going to see of Richard Manuel, for sure, even though it was sad and he was just so fucked up. And Levon he had a very obviously cynical outlook about the whole project, but it's still some pretty great interview footage of him.
Yeah, like you read Levon's book, This Wheel's on Fire, and he trashes The Last Waltz. Like, he hates the movie
big time.
And he talks about like how miserable he was being interviewed, but then like you watch the movie and he's like,
doesn't seem like it.
he's super charming. He's telling that story about like being in Arkansas and like how late at night, you know, girls just start shaking it and like the band starts playing a little, you know, like he's telling these great stories and it's so damn charming. But like apparently he hated the whole experience. I mean, I think he just hated being taken off the road and feeling that Robbie Robertson sort of decided that unilaterally, and he just associates that with the movie now, maybe. I don't know, but...
Well, and the whole Hollywood thing, which he was just, you know... I think at that point, there was just Robbie animosity overall.
Yeah, which is too bad. You know, I wish... because I do think some of his animosity, I think, is misplaced. And, you know, I do think that, like, I don't know how much we want to get into the weeds with that. We have to talk about these other movies, but I won't even get into that. Just listen to our episode on that. But, but I'll just say, like, I wish those two guys could have had a real reconciliation and not, like you said, where it seemed like Levon was unconscious and Robbie just kind of showed up at the end.
All right, what's your first entry?
So I'm going to go... So I just want to say, like, okay, so I mentioned that I had this list of movies that aren't on my list just because I felt like they're like the canon music movies, but I love all these movies, but I just wanted to maybe pick other movies that maybe people haven't seen. So like,
Those would be the honorable mentions.
Yeah. So like Last Waltz, Stop Making Sense. I had Gimme Shelter on there, the Rolling Stones movie.
Of course.
And, Don't Look Back, the Bob Dylan movie from 1967.
How can that not be in there?
Yeah, exactly. And these, and honestly, like my honorable mentions, like they could be my top five. But I was hoping I could maybe make some recommend. I feel like people have seen these movies, so like I wanted to recommend some things people haven't seen maybe. But the other one was A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles movie, 1964. It's one of the most, I mean, that's like one of my favorite movies, period, of all time.
Yeah.
Just super charming comedy. Aside from the music is obviously wonderful, but the comedy in that movie is so great and so many quotable lines, like all the other actors, like the guy who plays the grandpa is great, you know, so many wonderful parts of that movie. So those were the movies on my honorable mentions. My number five movie, and I have a bunch of parentheticals on this too. This is sort of like my comedy category.
Oh, okay.
And so obviously you have like, this is Spinal Tap. You have Pop Star, Never Stop Popping. You have the great movie. I don't know if you've seen this. All You Need Is Cash, the Ruddles movie that Eric Idle did in 1978, the Beatles parody. Yeah. Uh-huh. I love all those movies. Those are all basically like fake documentaries, you know, so sort of doing a parody of like the documentary genre. The movie that I actually put on my list at number five is a parody of music biopics. And I feel like after this movie was made, I'm shocked that music biopics continue to be a thing. Because this movie nails biopics so perfectly.
Yeah.
Like, I watched it again last night. Like, you can't watch this movie and then watch Bohemian Rhapsody and take it seriously. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody is kind of ridiculous anyway. Yeah. But anyway, the movie is Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. It's so perfect. Like, just nailing the sort of, like, awkwardness of biopics. The scene I was laughing the hardest. I always have a different scene that I laugh hard at, but like the scene early in the movie where they show young Dewey Cox in this grocery store, and he comes across these two blues guys, and then and then he takes a guitar and he starts he learns guitar instantly, and then he starts singing in this like blues guy voice. It's so perfect. It's so perfect for these things. And like how there's like a scene a little bit later where he's like, I'm going to walk hard. I'm going, you know, like how you have to like repeat the title of like a song, like in the dialogue, which is something that like happens all the time in Walk the Line, that Johnny Cash movie. I mean, they really nail the Johnny Cash movie pretty bad in Walk Hard, but,
And Walk the Line was a great movie too.
It is. Joaquin Phoenix and performance, I think, is great. Reese Witherspoon, I think, is great, but, just the sort of, reductive nature of biopics and how And just the corniness of them. Like Walk Hard, it just nails it so perfectly. So.
It's a tough genre, you know? Like, I love Bohemian Rhapsody, but just because I'm such a Queen fan.
Right.
I mean,
the Live Aid part is super entertaining. I mean, you can't not be roused by that. It's well done. But
they're a tough genre to pull off and make a really great movie. Like, if you're talking about really great movies, as much as I loved it, it was corny and cheesy and did not deserve like these Academy Awards, I don't think, but I think it hit me right in the feels because I'm such a Queen fan. Like, I didn't care. I forgave it of everything.
Right.
Because I just love it so much.
Yeah. You know, I kind of feel the same way. I mean, I can step back and I can point out all the flaws with it because it's a pretty ridiculous movie. And there's also like some weird things that they do with Freddie Mercury's story, especially at the end and like the chronology of like, when he got sick and when he found out about it, like there's some weird really things. Rearranged.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird if you know the real story, but, you're right. Like though, it's like you're in a movie theater listening to Queen music for 2 hours. So like, even if the movie is flawed, like, are you not having a good time? I mean, it's still a good time at the end of the day. So
yeah, totally.
You know, it's not a great movie, but it was a very entertaining movie, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So my next movie, I went for this one, movie about a fictional rock band, Almost Famous, which I think is a flawed movie in some ways in that it's sort of overly saccharine at times. But there's just something about it, man. When it came out, going to see that movie in the theater was a real experience. I think Cameron Crowe really nailed more than many directors I've seen what it might be like to be in a band. I thought he nailed the live music performance sections of that movie were amazing and really realistic. And it was just such a charming movie in every way. It was like the best of what I used to love about Cameron Crowe, like kind of before he started making what I think are pretty subpar movies. I love it. I love those songs. And I love that story. And that movie still holds a pretty special place in my heart.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I mean, as a music critic, that is the rare movie where a music critic is the hero of the film. Yeah,
it's kind of your story in some ways.
I mean, I've called that like the Top Gun of music criticism. Yeah. Like how like people saw Top Gun and are like, I want to join, you know, I want to fly airplanes, you know, it's like you see Almost Famous and you're like, I want to be a rock critic. This seems like the best.
And the Lester Bang stuff was so cool.
That's the thing. Like, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman's portrayal of Lester Bangs is that's more famous than Lester Bangs now. I
know
like he's like overtaken that, like reality. And I really think that like that version of Lester Bangs is like the most famous rock critic ever. You know,
it's I wish we could have seen that movie too.
Oh man, that would have been like a movie where it's just Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, hanging out with like Lou Reed and Iggy Pop. That would have been amazing. I love Almost Famous too. I agree with you about like the live music scenes. I appreciate that like Cameron Crowe made them like a credibly like okay band.
Yeah,
you know, like because I don't think Stillwater is supposed to be Led Zeppelin. Or the Allman Brothers. It's based on his experiences with those bands, but like they're not supposed to be as good as those bands. They're just supposed to be like kind of like a mid-level, like Black Oak, Arkansas or something.
Yeah, you know, like a theater sized.
Yeah, like a boogie rock band from the 70s. And like he co-wrote those songs with Nancy Wilson from Heart, who was his wife at the time. And like Fever Dog, you know, like songs like that. They did a good great job. Song. And I think to Almost Famous, what I respond to in it is like the love of music. Like it expresses what it means to love music so much or love a band so much in a really kind of pure and I think genuine way.
Yeah.
Where, it might be a little corny, but like, you know, loving a band is kind of corny. You know, that's the way it is. And like, that's kind of the great thing about it where you just kind of give yourself up to something and you're not self-conscious about it. You just love it unequivocally, you know, and I appreciate that fearlessness in a way, like to not be cool. I'm not going to be cool about this because I love it, you know, that's the way it should be.
Yeah, it was a pure love letter. And, you know, if you're a music fan, you can't help but love the end of that movie when Billy Crudup comes to that house and gives him that interview in the bedroom, and the way he wrote that, you know, I think the line was something like, what do you love most about music or being in a band? And he said something like, you know, to start with everything. and they just trail it off from there. And it's just, I still sort of get chills at that moment. It was just a love letter to rock and roll.
Yeah,
in every way.
Tangerine in the background, that Led Zeppelin song. God.
You have like the music cues were crazy.
And the bus going into the sunset at the end. It's like that iconography, that just speaks to me. Like, I will be a sucker for that any me day too. Of the week. So the next movie on my list is, you know, if you love The Last Waltz, I'd recommend this movie. It's a little less well known, but I think it's really great. It's called Chuck Berry, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
I've never seen that.
Great movie. Came out in 1987, directed by Taylor Hackford. It's about this concert that Chuck Berry played in his hometown of St. Louis. I guess it would have been 1986, when he was 60 years old. And he assembled this all-star band. Like, Keith Richards was on guitar. The bass player from NRBQ was on bass. I can't remember his name. I think Steve Jordan was on drums, and like Eric Clapton shows up at one point to
play. Eric Clapton always shows up.
Yeah, Eric Clapton. Yep. That's the link, I guess, between this and The Last Waltz.
Sure.
So it's a concert movie, but before the concert movie part of it begins, like, the first half of it is just about Chuck Berry and following him and just what his career was like at this moment in his life, how he was just flying from town to town playing with pickup bands. Like, he didn't have his own band. He just played with like local musicians, essentially. And like, Keith Richards talks about how, you know, he wants to do this concert because every time he's seen Chuck Berry, it's always been bad. He's like, he's always playing with these like local musicians who,
what a weird thing to do,
are good. Well, I think it was like, you know, it was probably cheaper for him to do that because you don't have a band on retainer. You know, you just show up. These guys are so excited just to play with Chuck Berry. Yeah,
he's taking 100% of the door.
Probably. Like, he's probably kicking these guys $50 and like a case of beer or something.
Interesting.
There's a great story. Bruce Springsteen's in the movie, and he tells a story about how Bruce Springsteen, early in his career, opened up for Chuck Berry, and like, his band ended up being Chuck Berry's backing band. Mm-hmm. So he tells this great story about how, like, they're on stage, you know, Bruce Springsteen's playing lead guitar or rhythm guitar or whatever in Chuck Berry's band, and like, he has no idea what Chuck's about to play, and they have to figure out, like, Chuck just counts in and starts playing, and, you know, Chuck Berry, like, the riffs of his songs, they kind of sound alike, so they have to figure out what song they're playing and in what key, and it's just amazing.
Bruce was always good on the fly like that, though.
Yeah, totally.
And had been known to do stuff like that in his own band, like, you know, follow me in G.
Right, exactly. It's just wild to see, you know, just to imagine like a young Bruce Springsteen playing with Chuck Berry. It's kind of like a dream type thing to imagine.
That's so cool.
So, yeah, great movie. Great, you know, it's great. I mean, the concert part of it is great. But like, all the stuff that leads up to it is great. There's a great scene like where Chuck Berry and Keith Richards get into an argument, like where they're just screaming at each other over like how to properly play some song.
Really?
So, wonderful movie. And yeah, I feel like it was critically acclaimed at the time and it's been overlooked a little bit over the years.
I think you're right.
But definitely seek it out. It's really great.
All right. I got to add that to the old list. It's something I've seen clips of over the years. A lot, but for some reason just never got to it.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so my next one is a movie about a fictional Motown R&B band, and it is Dreamgirls, the great 2006 film from Bill Condon. I love Dreamgirls. My wife loves Dreamgirls. I think it's got some of the best original songs of any music movie of all time. The acting is amazing. Eddie Murphy is unbelievable. Jamie Foxx, Beyonce. I mean, it's really one of my favorite music movies of all time. And I grew up as a kid. Like, my parents weren't into music very much. I didn't have the dad that was like, hey, this is Simon and Garfunkel, you got to listen to this. This is amazing.
Right.
Like, they sort of liked music, but it just wasn't a big thing. Like, I got my music from listening to Casey Kasem every weekend and being a Radiohead as a, you know, 9-year-old. And the one album they did have, though, was the Big Chill soundtrack, like every boomer. And when I was whatever, I mean, I can't even remember when that came out. I had to be like 8 or 9. I was introduced to some of the best music in history. And I was introduced to Motown. And from that moment on, I was like, I was a 9 and 10 year old that was listening to Aretha Franklin and the Supremes and Otis Redding and I mean, you name it, man. And it just, it's a love that is still with me today. I still love, one of my favorite things to do, and it's just a big group hangout, is just put on a Motown. You can never go wrong with a Motown playlist.
Oh yeah.
As far as just satisfying the most people with like good time music.
Yeah. It's the easiest music on the planet to like. I mean, who doesn't really like Motown? I mean, no matter what genre you might be into.
Yeah.
You're putting on, you know, Supremes or Four Tops or something. Yeah, people are going to respond positively to it. I've never seen Dreamgirls. I've heard it's great. I've heard Eddie Murphy's great. I heard he got robbed for the Oscar. You gotta see it, man.
It's great. I mean, the songs themselves are just phenomenal. And it's, yeah, I mean, you know, it's broad. I think it was a Broadway show before it was a movie, if I'm not mistaken. Really, really great, great movie.
Have you seen that movie Standing in the Shadows of Motown, about the backing musicians?
I have that in 20 Feet from Stardom.
Yeah.
Are a couple of my favorite, sort of behind the scenes docs.
Those are good. Yeah. Just the whole Motown factory. It's such a fascinating period that they could just like turn out this music in a very sort of like automated kind of way. And yet it was so great and it had so much soul to it. You'd think that there'd be a chance that this music could be kind of like, you know, forgettable, you know, because they were just churning it out so much. But
right.
Those musicians were so great, and the songwriters were just like the greatest ever. You know, they just hit upon a groove, and it was phenomenal.
Yeah.
So my next film is a movie that it's part of this wave. Like in the last 10 years, there's been just like a ton of like music documentaries that have come out. That are authorized documentaries. Like there was just this past week, HBO, they debuted the Bee Gees documentary, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart?
Which I can't wait to see that.
It's, you know, I have a couple qualms with it, but overall, uh-huh, I really, really liked it. I think it's a very entertaining movie. But I think like the best example of like this recent run of like artist authorized docs is History of the Eagles, which came out, I think, in like 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And this is a movie where, you know, if you don't like the Eagles, I think you would actually enjoy this film more than a person who loves the Eagles, because it's the rare movie like this that I think is an actual warts and all depiction where the main guys do not come off very well. Like Don Henley, Glenn Frey don't come off very well. To what degree that was, that they were conscious of that, I don't know. It may have been over their heads a little bit. But this movie, to me, it's such an entertaining snapshot, I think, of like what happened to rock music between the early 70s and the early 90s. If you just wanted to like kind of see one story that like traced how rock music went from being this sort of like hippie, feel good kind of music to being like uber corporatized, you know, boomer sort of like nostalgia thing by the 90s. This film covers it covers it perfectly. It's like a long movie. It's about 3.5 hours long. There's like two parts to it. But it's so colorful. There's so many colorful characters in this movie. It's very quotable. Are we allowed to swear on this podcast, or do you keep it? Okay, so one of my favorite scenes in this movie is like it comes in the second half where David Geffen is talking about his feud with Don Henley, and he looks into the camera and he says, you know, and I think this is something he said to Don. He said, "I'd rather die than let you fuck me."
Yeah,
and that's a line I quote all the time. I just think that's a hilarious line. And by the way, we will definitely be doing a multi-part series on the Eagles on Rivals very soon. But yeah, you know, if you love 70s rock, if you love just like kind of down and dirty, like feuding, this movie is for you. And again, if you hate the Eagles, I know a lot of people hate the Eagles. I actually think you'll like this movie more because than if you're a fan, because it'll justify your dislike of them, but you'll also be entertained by the movie as well.
Yeah. So here's my history of the Eagles is I grew up a really big Eagles fan. When I was a kid, I loved the Eagles and, knew all those songs backwards and forwards. Then I think because of classic rock radio, which is, there's a great line in that movie where I think Henley is saying like, we were kind of fading away and then classic rock radio started and that was it.
Like right.
You could hear our songs forever now. And he's right. In 100 years, they'll be playing the Eagles on a classic rock radio station.
Right.
But it got so overplayed and, I sort of also got caught up in the anti-Eagles thing that came about, which I think Big Lebowski has a little bit to lay on its shoulders.
Absolutely.
I kind of was done and didn't listen to the Eagles at all for many, many years. And this documentary made me rediscover my love for the Eagles to where I was like, why am I not listening to this band? I fucking love these songs. And that all culminated with me going to see this last Eagles tour as a guest. A Stuff You Should Know listener is one of the techs. He's not a guitar tech. He sort of does like, I don't want to divulge what he actually does, but he's on the crew, like a high place member of the road crew. And he invited my wife and I and gave us, like, I got to stand on the stage at Phillips Arena with the curtain up, with everyone out there, with like 15,000 people kind of stirring. And I got to touch Don Henley's drum set. And I got to touch, you know, Glenn Frey's son has all his dad's guitars there. And I got to like touch those and touch Joe Walsh's guitars. And it was amazing, dude. It was a great show. What can you say about going to a concert where they play 35 songs that everybody knows by heart?
Right.
It's a ridiculous amount of great music and huge, huge monster hits. So that documentary was a big deal for me. That really made me rediscover my love for them.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, I have like a love-hate relationship with the Eagles for like the reason that you're saying that like they were a band that would, I just felt like you could not get away from for the longest time. But if you can actually step back and just look at those songs as like craftsmanship, I mean, they are like, you know, they're like a brick shit house of songwriting. I mean, you cannot penetrate those songs. They're like just perfectly written. They're almost like too perfect sometimes. Like, cause I sometimes like things that aren't quite that well crafted, but you can't deny, you know, what they put into those songs. There's a reason why those songs are played so much. Like you hear Take It Easy and it's like, it's kind of like a perfectly written song, you know, from beginning to end. But I just want to say, because I know some people instantly recoil at the Eagles, I think because of the Big Lebowski thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, and I'm just saying, like, if you're not a fan, I think you'll still enjoy this movie.
Still watch it.
Because the story itself is, like, so interesting, and the characters in that movie are so colorful that it's more entertaining than most documentaries about a band that you might actually love, you know?
Like, yeah.
There's so much there that I think is really great. So, yeah, History of the Eagles.
All right. Number four on my list is actually my favorite documentary about a band. And this is hard because the list is long. But as a Tom Petty fan, it doesn't get any better than Peter Bogdanovich's epic, like 4-hour documentary on Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Running Down a Dream. It's just, I mean, all rock documentaries should be 4 hours long.
You know,
after you've seen this.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the Eagles one is that long too. I was thinking that during the Bee Gees documentary, like that is one of my quibbles with that movie is that that's another band with a fascinating story where it could be 3 or 4 hours long. And they end up cutting out some things that I think are interesting for the sake, in order to keep it under 2 hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm so glad you brought up this movie. Like this, might be my favorite movie to watch if I'm up late at night. And yeah. I've had some, shall we say, chemical enhancement, and I sure. And I just want to hang out and feel good.
Yeah, man.
Put on Running Down a Dream. Like, I will always be happy to see that movie. It just puts me in like the happiest place.
It's the best. I mean, there was no one better than Tom Petty, and the Warren Zanes book is just amazing. Like, I can just give it all to me. If Stan Lynch wrote a book, I would read it.
Mm.
I think that's
gotta happen.
Potential, that's a Rivals episode at some point, probably,
oh,
right?
Oh, man. Yeah. Or, I mean, Stan Lynch and Jimmy Iovine, you know, who...
Yeah.
I just wrote a huge... I wrote a list of, like, my favorite... 100 favorite Tom Petty songs. It was, like, a 12,000-word story I wrote.
And I gotta read that.
And one of my beefs in there was, you watch that movie and you watch other Tom Petty things, Jimmy Iovine is always knocking Stan Lynch's drumming. And I think Stan Lynch is a great drummer. I love his drumming. I love his backing vocals. I love him as a personality. Like, I think he's funny. I could see how he would be obnoxious if you're Tom Petty. Like, because he was always, I think, kind of giving Tom shit a little bit. But
and he was a rock star. He was tall and good looking and
right.
sort of brash and all about the chicks. And I don't know. I think he added a sort of a wild card element to that band, though, that I love. I mean, no knocking. Was it Steve Ferrone?
Yeah, he's a great drummer, too. But like, yeah, he
amazing.
Was
amazing.
But he wasn't. He was going to do what Tom said, you know,
right.
Like Stan Lynch. I think I love the Heartbreakers with Steve Ferrone, but like I it seems like the Heartbreakers with Stan Lynch is like a different entity. It kind of feels like more like a real band type thing. Where each guy's got a personality to it. And
yeah. I think that's what really comes through in the documentary, too, is because of his success as a quote-unquote solo artist, I think it's sort of is like Bruce Springsteen, the E Street Band. But the Heartbreakers were, he always wanted to think of themselves as a real band. Like, if it was up to Tom Petty, they may have just been called the Heartbreakers.
Right.
And not Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And one of my favorite parts of that documentary is the Stevie Nicks story when, you know, they're obviously such good friends and she wanted to join them. And like, it's Stevie fucking Nicks. And Tom Petty in that Gainesville drawl just goes, we don't have girls in the Heartbreakers. He says it in such a sweet way. It's just such a great line.
It's wild. Then you know, Mike Campbell ends up in Stevie Nicks' band.
I know.
Later, you know, like she obviously just wanted a little bit of that Heartbreakers.
Yeah.
Feel. You know,
that was a great tour.
I didn't get to see that. I've never seen Fleetwood Mac. They're like one of my big sort of holes in my history. Although I love Fleetwood Mac, obviously. Yeah, I think with the Heartbreakers, even more than the E Street Band, like Mike Campbell and Ben Montench, those two guys, especially like what they brought to Tom Petty songs,
man.
It's so integral where, I mean, anytime he did another project, he still brought those guys, you know, like he had to have Mike Campbell, writing Shotgun and Ben Montench just as a keyboardist is like one of my all time favorites.
Yeah. He's amazing. He was just a kid.
Yeah.
When they started. He was the youngin'.
Yeah. And like a wild man too until he sobered up. I mean, it seems like he was like the big party guy in the band, which I was a little surprised by when I watched the movie. I wouldn't have thought that necessarily, but he's a cool dude.
What's next?
My next movie is I think one of the great movies of all time. Not just a music movie, but just as a movie period, and that is Robert Altman's Nashville. Which came out in 1975. And one of the great things about this movie, and I feel like it was maybe the first movie to do this, is that you have all these actors in the movie who aren't musicians, but like they actually ended up like writing their own songs and like playing instruments. So it's not one of those things where you watch a music movie and the actor starts playing a song and they're clearly like lip syncing something, which I know for me, always takes me out of the movie.
Oh, totally. You know,
if you're watching a movie and like it's clearly not their voice and they're clearly not playing the guitar, it's like, or they show like a live music scene and like, you know, the live sound is like way too perfect.
Yeah.
And people in the audience can talk to each other and they don't have to shout. You know, it's like it's so phony. And in Nashville, along with just obviously the great drama of that movie and all the great actors that are in it, I think like the way live music is presented in Nashville is so great. And I think like the classic scene in that movie, I think, is the scene like where Keith Carradine is in this nightclub and he starts playing a song called I'm Easy.
Yeah, which great
is a
song.
Which is a song that he wrote, which is it's a phenomenal song. And he's playing it and all these women that he's like slept with are in the audience. Mm-hmm. And they think that he's singing to them. And then finally they realize that, no, he's singing directly to Lily Tomlin, who's in the back,
right.
who he hasn't slept with yet. He's like trying to seduce her and he's playing this song. And it's just such a wonderful movie. It's a great snapshot of like what that city was in the mid 70s, like the country music industry, but just also just a great snapshot of America. And obviously the ending is crazy. I won't say what the ending is if you haven't seen it, but wonderful movie, highly recommended. Great music movie and just a great American film, period.
Yeah, that's, I mean, one of the masters. That was actually covered on this show. It was it's the favorite movie of John Cameron Mitchell.
Ooh.
Which I thought was pretty cool. And, you know, we might as well go ahead and throw Hedwig and the Angry Inch as one of the great music movies of all time, too.
I've not seen that.
Oh, dude.
I need to see that. It sounds like so I really need to see it. I've heard it's awesome. For some reason, I don't know why I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, great music. So my number five is a three-way tie, and I'm just going to categorize this as behind-the-scenes docs. And 20 Feet from Stardom is one that we mentioned, along with Muscle Shoals and Wrecking Crew. And as you know, Muscle Shoals and the Wrecking Crew are about these two sort of groups of legendary backing musicians. And the, geez, I guess the, when did they start? The 50s through 70s?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Roughly. And these, you know, these players that played on some of the most iconic songs of all time and with the most iconic bands of all time. And they were largely unsung to a certain degree. You know, speaking of Drive-By Truckers, Patterson Hood's dad, David Hood, was I think he was a bass player, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And on some of these great records. And it's just cool to see them get their due. Same with 20 Feet from Stardom and I guess Standing in the Shadows of Motown with the backup singers. These people that are so talented and were comfortable in that position of knowing like, you know what, I'm never going to be the Rolling Stones or the Beach Boys, but I might play in a session for these guys.
Yeah. I love when music films can access history like that through an unexpected portal, you know?
Yeah.
It's typical, I think, to make a movie about a really famous person and to focus on their story. But sometimes those don't work as well because it's like, well, we know these stories already, or we already have a fixed idea of like who these big superstars are. And it can be, and if you watch a movie, especially if it's like an actor playing a famous person, a lot of times it doesn't work because you're like, well, you're not that guy. I know what that other person is. So, you know, I feel like those movies are great because you're meeting these musicians, but it's also like, it's another way to talk about like this wonderful music of the 60s and 70s that we all know, but like maybe we don't know this aspect of it. You know, I like with the Muscle Shoals, I remember being blown away just realizing that, you know, because I'm aware of like the, you know, like Aretha Franklin and like a lot of the great soul people that recorded there. But like Bob Seger, like most of his great hits were recorded there, you know, and all those guys play on those songs. And it just shows like they could play like with a lot of different artists and and make it work. I mean, because they were just such great musicians. So, yeah, it's great to be able to learn those stories, you know, and kind of add to your appreciation of music you already love.
Yeah, for sure. So that was my last on that list. I do have honorable mentions, but what's your number five?
So, and this is actually, I had it number one on my list. Okay. Although like all these could be number one, but I do love this movie a lot. And it's kind of related to what we were just talking about, because this is a film that I think did a really clever thing where, instead of making a movie about Bob Dylan, in the early 60s, like when he was first starting out in New York mm-hmm. in Greenwich Village in the folk scene, they made a movie about a character who could have been in that scene at the same time, who uh-huh. was like in Bob Dylan's orbit, but they just focused on him and made it about him and made it a movie not about success, but about failure and yeah, about coming to terms with failure. And that's Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh man.
The Coen Brothers movie.
One of my
movie.
Favorites.
Yeah. This is like one of my favorite, I think, just Coen Brothers movies, which is like a great honor for me to, I mean, like, cause I love pretty much all their movies.
Yeah. And same.
I find that I have different favorites all the time, but Inside Llewyn Davis is always among my top favorite of their films.
So great.
And, you know, like I was saying, I love that idea that like, because in a way, I think that is like a Bob Dylan movie. And like Bob Dylan shows yeah. up at the end.
Uh-huh.
And like, it's so perfect. And you don't see him clearly. You hear him. And he's seen, he's presented in a way as like a sign of doom. Because it's like there's this guy, you know, Oscar Isaac, brilliant performance by Oscar Isaac as yeah. Llewyn Davis. And he's trying to make it. He's this sort of more kind of conventional folk singer. And it's like, no. Like, you're not going to be famous. You're not going to ever make it. There's this other guy who's just entered the scene. He's going to, like, do all the things that you wanted to do. And I don't know. It's just such a great portrait to me. Because, you know, I feel like a lot of, you know, documentaries or books or whatever, it always focuses on the people who made it. You know, the icons, the legends. Uh-huh. But I'm interested in the people who didn't make it. You know, the people who failed. In a way, that's more relatable. It's another reason why this is a movie I could have put on my list. Amadeus, the Milos Forman film, which I think is a brilliant film. And it's a mm-hmm. similar thing where, you know, like Mozart's in that movie, but it's really about Salieri. It's really about this guy who was very successful in his time, but he wasn't going to be legendary like Mozart. And his curse is that he can recognize that. Like, he mm-hmm. recognizes the genius of this guy, and he knows what it means for him. He knows that it means, like, I'm just, like, a hack, really, compared to this guy. And how painful that is to realize. And I think there's a nice parallel there with Inside Llewyn Davis. It's a similar kind of thing.
Who is he based on? What was that guy's name?
I think it's... Is this I guess I'm not educated enough on classical music. I guess I thought there actually was a Salieri, but is there not actually?
No. I mean, Llewyn Davis.
Oh, Llewyn Davis.
Dave Van Ronk.
Yeah, Dave Van Ronk. I think that was like, I don't think it, because Dave Van Ronk wrote a biography called The Mayor of McDougal Street. And I think some of the details from that book are in the film. I don't think, I don't know if he's like supposed to be Dave Van Ronk exactly.
I think it's just a loose inspiration.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Just a great movie, great soundtrack.
Oh, man, the songs are so good.
And it's a movie I like to watch this time of the year, especially because
it's a good winter movie.
It's a great winter movie, yeah. So
he's always cold.
He's always cold. And, I mean, the scene in that movie that always stands out to me, it's funny that I just brought up Amadeus because F. Murray Abraham has one scene in Inside Llewyn Davis. Good. He shows up to... You know, Oscar Isaac shows up to audition at this famous folk club in Chicago. He's like traveled across the country, gone through all these problems. He plays them one song and he says, I don't hear a lot of money in this.
Yeah.
And it's funny and it's heartbreaking, but it's like such an accurate sort of depiction of like, this guy's really good. He has a lot of talent, but you're not going to be the guy. You know, you're not going to make anyone $1 million. And that's it. You had one audition and it's over. And
it's so funny, man.
So brilliant.
I mean, Timberlake is so good. Adam Driver, Stark Sands, who plays Troy Nelson.
Oh, yeah.
Garrett Hedlund. I mean, John Goodman. It's such a great movie. I just pulled up my favorite line of dialogue, if you'll allow me, from Carrie Mulligan as Jean when she says, they have that great scene in Washington Square Park and she just hates him so much. She said, I should have had you wear double condoms, but if you ever do it again, which is a favor to women everywhere, you should not. But if you do, you should be wearing condom on condom and then wrap it in electrical tape. You should just walk around always inside a great big condom because you are shit. I love that movie so much, man. Yeah. And the look of it, that sort of, it's just a gorgeous movie to look at. I love everything about it.
Yeah, it's kind of like fuzzy around the edges, you know? It kind of has like, it feels like it's a little frosted over in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like a sepia tone, but like it's not, I don't know, there's something about that movie where it's romantic on one level, but
yeah,
it's also like kind of brutal. At the same time,
brothers.
Yeah, like it just it's just like digs in like the knife. Like there's that scene too, like where Gene's on stage, I think it's Gene, and Max Casella is the owner of the club,
yeah,
and he's just talking about the other, like all the women he wants to sleep with. He's like, yeah, that Gene, love to sleep with Gene. He doesn't say sleep with, but yeah, it's so good, man. It's such a great movie, and
great choice.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that would be number one on my list today. But if I was on your show again tomorrow talking about music movies, I'd probably have a different number.
It's not fair.
Yeah.
And I'll have you back for sure because we have clearly a lot to talk about. But my honorable mentions, and I'm just going to kind of tick through these quickly. If you're looking for good music movies and documentaries, there's a movie called Sing Street, which is just fantastic.
Love that movie.
From the director of Once, another great music movie. Sing Street coming of age movie set in, I guess, is it Ireland or is it Scotland? Yeah, it's Dublin.
Okay.
In 1985. So if you have any love for sort of early to mid 80s new wave wrapped in a great coming of age love story, I would highly recommend Sing Street.
Absolutely. I'll second that.
Along those similar lines, geographically, 24 Hour Party People.
Oh,
another great movie.
Yes. I rewatched that not that long ago. Steve Coogan.
It's so good. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Just a tour de force.
Another movie about a time in music history that just really encapsulates what was going on at Factory Records and just sort of the birth of this genre almost.
Yeah. So good. I was also going to say, there's a movie called Control, which is it's a biopic about Joy Division.
Yeah, very small indie style,
which is a good movie. I mean, because 24 Hour Party People kind of has like a Joy Division biopic tucked inside of it, like the first half of it, and like the Ian Curtis in that movie is so great. Yeah, that movie is so good. Yeah, that could have been on my list easily.
I'm waiting for a great Smiths movie. I know that they did one a few years ago, but I don't think it was very well received, so I didn't even see it.
I wasn't even aware that there was a Smiths movie.
Yeah, let me see here. I'm going to look it up. It's called England Is Mine from 3 years ago, based on the early years of Morrissey. But it wasn't supposed to be very good, so I kind of was like, I don't even want to. Sometimes if you love a band, you don't want it tainted by a bad depiction.
Right. Oh yeah. It can be so annoying to see a movie about a band you love and they just get everything wrong. Yeah.
A handful of documentaries that I think are great over the last like 10 years, Searching for Sugar Man. Great, great movie with a cool central mystery, a band called Death. Great documentary about this kind of unknown, Detroit punk band, all black punk band, which was a very much an outsider kind of thing at the time.
Yeah, I like that movie.
Great
too.
Documentary. David Crosby, Remember My Name.
Oh, yeah.
Really, warts and all. If you want to talk about warts and all documentaries, it's such a sad thing to watch on one hand, and that he's just like, I've been an asshole my whole life, and now I'm alone because of it.
I know. Well, and yeah, we did a 4-part series on Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
That was so great.
It was 3 parts, actually. But yeah, I'm a sucker for any CSNY content.
Oh, man. I mean, their story is crazy with the number of beefs and allegiances. And like, I'll go make a record with you, but not you. And now we'll get together and make some music, but not him. And we'll tour together, but Neil Young will be out of here in 3 weeks. And it's just such a crazy story. Let me see here. Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice.
Yes.
Great, great doc.
Love that.
Beats, Rhymes, and Life, A Tribe Called Quest, from Michael Rapaport. It's a little uneven and not the best film, but if you love A Tribe Called Quest, it's a pretty great documentary.
Yeah, I was a fan of that too. I enjoyed it.
Festival Express.
Yes. Did you see that? Yeah, I did. That's about like that Canada tour with the band and Grateful Dead.
On the train.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Great, great footage. Some of the best archival footage of some of those groups.
Oh, yeah.
And then more recently, 8 Days a Week, the touring years about the Beatles from Ron Howard. Fantastic.
That's great. I have a couple recommendations here, too. I guess honorable mentions. In terms of just like overblown biopics that I love, Oliver Stone's The Doors is a movie that is like so campy. I quoted a bit of dialogue from this movie in the epigraph of my second book, Twilight of the Gods, just because I loved it. It was just this, it was like a total biopic scene, like where Ray Manzarek is saying, like, you know, people are in the streets, man. They're looking for something that we need to be the spokesman of our generation. And then Jim Morrison says, yeah, man, there should be orgies too.
Yeah. You know?
So I rewatched The Doors recently. It's so ridiculous, but I love it.
Does it hold up?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. If you embrace the ridiculous, overblown, like, you know, sort of campiness of it, I think it's great. Like, I really enjoy it. And I like The Doors too. Like, they're another band like the Eagles that people...
Sure.
Have a hate.
Seems like you have a phase.
Yeah, where you hate the, where you love them for a while, then I think it's kind of fashionable to hate them, but.
Yeah, I mean, I loved The Doors in college. I was in a big Doors phase when that movie came out. So it was an event. Like, we went opening night, and I thought it was like one of the best rock and roll movies I'd ever seen.
Right.
And just haven't seen it much since then. So I'm sort of afraid to.
Maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you should just preserve that memory, but I think it's a lot of fun.
Let it be there.
I enjoy it. Another movie that I like that's more of like an unconventional rock movie, but I think it's really great is Velvet Goldmine, the Todd Haynes movie from 1998.
Oh, hell yeah.
Where they didn't have the rights to the David Bowie catalog, but like he still made it work. And like, I think it's a great movie about like the idea of David Bowie and like a fan's perspective, like one fan's perspective on what he meant. And, you know, great performances by Ian McGregor, plays like a Iggy Pop type person. I don't think he's Iggy Pop, but he's like
so great.
Clearly based on him. Great movie. A great movie from like the early 80s that I think has been overlooked a little bit over the years. Tender Mercies, Bruce Beresford's movie. Robert Duvall won an Oscar for this movie for best actor.
Amazing movie.
It's a movie that like if you've seen Crazy Heart, the Jeff Bridges movie, this is like the precursor to that. Like where Robert Duvall is like a alcoholic country singer who's trying to remake his life. I like Crazy Heart. I think Tender Mercies is a much better movie. It's really beautiful, really well done, gentle movie.
Agree.
This is another movie like Robert Duvall like wrote his own songs for this movie and he sings them in the movie and it really kind of gives like an authenticity to this, like it's kind of like a Waylon Jennings type person. But definitely seek that out. Wonderful movie. And the last one I'm going to recommend, this is a movie that like I avoided for a long time because I thought I wouldn't like it. I thought I'd be annoyed by it, but I saw it recently and I really loved it.
Okay.
It's Edgar Wright's Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
We just covered that on the show. It's a great, great movie.
It's a great movie. I don't know why I thought I wouldn't like it, but it's a great movie and it's a great snapshot of like sort of like a pop punk emo indie rock world of like when that movie came out, which would have been, I think like the late aughts, like 2010 or so. I think that came out.
Yeah. Something like that.
It's a very busy movie, like very, you know, lots of things happening at once, but, it feels like a video game essentially. But it's really well made, really funny and engaging. I thought Michael Cera was great. You know, Jason Schwartzman is in it. Brie Larson plays this, ex-girlfriend who's like a rock star. And like, she's really great in that role. Yeah. There's like
so many people before they like really blew up were in that movie.
Yeah. Really great cast. And like, actually I think like a really good soundtrack too, of like sort of like sound alike songs like done in that style. So if you're like me and you were like, oh, I'm not gonna like that movie, definitely see that movie. Although I'm sure I feel like most people love that movie. It's a pretty beloved cult movie by now,
for sure.
But yeah, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So I feel like we could just keep listing movies forever. I keep thinking of new movies I want to talk about, but
consider this part one then. You know, we'll have you back. I think it'd be fun to talk more about movies we love. And also, it might be fun to talk a little bit about some of the ones that have really gone wrong. Because there have been some bad, bad rock and roll movies about either great bands or ideas, like the CBGB movie, where you're just like, oh man, how could you fuck that up? So maybe it'd be fun if you came back for a part two where we kind of talked about both our favorites and some of the ones that they just really screwed up.
That would be phenomenal, man. I would really enjoy that.
All right, Steve. Well, it was great meeting you, my friend. I knew this was going to go this way and that we would probably go for like 3 hours if we had nothing else going on in our lives. But thank you for giving me so much time. I have a lot of new great recommendations. I'm going to go read this Tom Petty from Up Rocks, the best Tom Petty songs ranked, right after we hang up.
Okay.
And go check out your books. Buy them. Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me, about musical rivalries. Twilight of the Gods, about sort of, you know, the heyday of classic rock. The Black Crowes book, Hard to Handle. And most recently, This Isn't Happening. If you love Radiohead and Kid A, can't wait to start this book. Go out and buy these books. And great. Listen to Rivals.
Yes. Charles, right, thank you so much.
Movie Crush is produced and written by Charles Bryant and Noel Brown, edited and engineered by Seth Nicholas Johnson, and scored by Noel Brown here in our home studio at Ponce Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.